Welcome to the Burning Archive. I'm Jeff Rich, and today I'm talking about the German writer who lived subsequently in Britain, Max, or W.G. Winfried, his name was, Sebald, the author of The Rings of Saturn. And I'll talk a bit about his histories of destruction before reading the first chapter, indeed, of his extraordinary and unclassifiable piece of prose, The Rings of Saturn. While walking through abandoned military facilities in East Anglia, the writer W.G. Sebald, author of The Rings of Saturn, imagined himself amidst the remains of our own civilization after its extinction in some future catastrophe. Such stirrings of the imagination come to all of us today, now and then, while we scroll our phones and witness too many horrors of war that haunt our modern lives. Who today, amidst news reports of world leaders playing a dangerous game of brinkmanship with nuclear powers, does not occasionally have intimations of our own civilization's mortality? We do not need to walk among military facilities to know the power of destruction, but can glance through any social media stream at bombed children, ruined cities, and deceitful leaders urging others to fight and to die for their ambition. Yet to look intently at the ruins of war and the horror of that destruction is difficult, exhausting, and depressing. If you have even a partial knowledge of the history of humanity, you realize that the records of such destruction stretch back so long, so deep, and so wide that you cannot readily imagine escaping that ultimate catastrophe Sebald saw amidst military ruins in East Anglia. Sebald, The Rings of Saturn, is a book that has supported me to witness the horrors of history for decades now. Over the last fortnight, I reread this strange, hybrid, mesmerizing book. It was a conscious decision to seek, in the beauty of this meditation on the ruins wrought by history, some way of enduring and thriving despite so many intimations of catastrophe. The author of this book was Winfried George Sebald, 1944 to 2001. He was a German writer and academic who had moved to Britain in young adulthood. He preferred to use the first name of Max, and this decision was in part the rejection of his family heritage, which was tainted by participation in the Nazi regime of Germany and willing blindness to the Holocaust. In his late teens, Sebald broke with his father, who had served in the Wehrmacht under the Nazis and was a prisoner of war until 1947. In the years after the war, his father and family and many fellow Germans and Europeans did not face the trauma, guilt and horror provoked by the events which they participated in and witnessed from the 1920s to the 1940s. Sebald, however, refused to blind himself either to the horrors of the Holocaust or to the destruction wrought on Germany by the Allies. The ruins of German cities and the losses of so many Germans, at least some of whom were innocent civilians and not party to the Nazi crimes, haunted a generation of German citizens, leaders, writers, and intellectuals. How could they speak of German loss, trauma, and suffering when Germany, or its leaders and allies, had perpetrated such war crimes? What redemption was there after participation or complicity or negligence in such horrors? As Adorno wrote, there can be no poetry after the Holocaust. Yet, on the other hand, how could they not speak of the traumas they had known when orphans and neglected children roamed across the rubble of their cities, when everyone knew someone who had been killed, maimed, raped, persecuted, or tortured? Sebald's father and family retreated into silence. So too did many Germans and many more or less guilty followers in other nations. But Sebald himself, from his school years, refused to do so. While at school he was shown films and photographs of the Holocaust, he sought explanations from teachers, his family, and the witnesses of this horror. But no one spoke to him honestly, and no one knew how to explain what they had just seen. Nor did anyone speak frankly about the mass destruction by bombing raids of British and American Allied forces, consciously planned by Bomber Harris to terrorize the civilian population. These raids on 131 German cities killed 600,000 German civilians and destroyed 3.5 million homes. In instants, whole cities were incinerated, such as in the firebombing of Dresden or in Germany's ally, Japan, of Tokyo. The destruction would culminate in the atomic bombs dropped by the USA on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Sebald wrote much later in On the Natural History of Destruction, "The darkest aspects of the final act of destruction as experienced by the great majority of the German population remained under a kind of taboo, like a shameful family secret. A secret that perhaps could not even be privately acknowledged." These themes of the destruction and cruelty that reached their pinnacle in the Holocaust, but are enacted in many other ways in past and modern civilizations, especially through warfare, persecution, and exploitation of nature. These themes became central to Sebald's writing. He would write as a wandering alien from his country and an exiled citizen from his culture. These themes lay at the enigmatic secret heart of the strange book, The Rings of Saturn. It is a book of haunting beauty and extraordinary, untimely prose, which are reasons why I return again and again to this book for consolation amidst the horrors and ruins of our times. It has been variously classified as novel, fiction, essay, memoir, travelogue, creative nonfiction, or simply writing. Michael Hamburger, the poet and translator who appears in disguised form in the book, offered the best description of its form. It was, he said, an essayistic semi-fiction which gives rope to both observation and imagination. This essayistic semi-fiction is also a form of history and a deep reflection on the difficulties of recovering, remembering, and writing about the past. Faintly evoking Walter Benjamin's famed fable of the angel of history, her face turned in tears to the past as the storm of progress blows her fast to the future. Sebald reflected frequently in The Rings of Saturn on the puzzling difficulty of remembering the past. He wrote, "This then, I thought, as I looked round about me, is the representation of history. It requires a falsification of perspective. We, the survivors, see everything from above, see everything at once, and still we do not know how it was. W.G. Sebald, The Rings of Saturn. The book has, therefore, always been an important work in the Burning Archive. It is a book that set a course for my writing. After falling under Sebald's spell, I resolved to write semi-historical essays, not fiction, not academic history. His manner of associative digressions and his style of retrieved pre-modernist elegance have informed how I write, or at least aspire to write. It may be evident in this talk, and certainly in some of the essays in my books, From the Burning Archive and 13 Ways of Looking at a Bureaucrat. The Rings of Saturn is also a book that honours by following the unique paths of strange and remarkable writers. In the first three pages of the book, we meet Kafka. Along the way, we meet the translator, the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, Swinburne, Chateaubriand, and Joseph Conrad. However, much of the book is a tribute to one great English essayist who was buried in Norwich, as told by Sebald in The Rings of Saturn, and whose skull is one focus of the first mesmerizing chapter of the book. That writer is Sir Thomas Browne, who lived between 1605 and 1682. He was an English doctor who practiced in Norwich and an essayist who, Sebald says, as a disciple of his famously elaborate prose, left a number of writings that defy all comparisons. Browne practiced medicine in an era transitioning from Renaissance to Enlightenment, but which knew much abominable darkness. The 17th century was a period of rolling global crises, which some argue were connected to changes in weather patterns, as, for example, is set out in Geoffrey Parker, Global Crisis, War, Climate Change, and the catastrophe in the 17th century. It was a period of religious and civil wars across Europe, including Russia, which included the 30 Years' War, the Time of Troubles, or Smuta, and the overthrow of the Ming in China. In Britain, it was the era of the English Civil War and Cromwell's brutal puritanical commonwealth. The English Civil War bled hundreds of thousands of victims, a few of whom Browne sought to heal, and hundreds of ideological zealots from whom Browne kept his distance. He reflected on the religious and ideological disputes of a Britain that had descended into devil land, as set out in Claire Jackson's Devil Land, England Under Siege, 1588 to 1688. He described those ideological disputes in his essay Religio Medici, or A Doctor's Religion. There he wrote, "I could never divide myself from any man upon the difference of an opinion, or be angry with his judgment for not agreeing with me in that from which, perhaps within a few days, I should dissent myself." Thomas Browne, Religio Medici. Sebald returns throughout the book to this articulate and compassionate witness of the destructive horrors of a world in crisis. But although on the surface the book reads as the memoir of a walking tour in East Anglia, he draws in many other testimonies to cruelty and compassion in history. We read of the brutal destruction of Beijing by English forces in the 19th century, and the cold cruelty of the last Chinese Dowager Empress. We read of Joseph Conrad's experiences in the Congo that led to the creation of the character Kurtz, who in his deaf scene in Heart of Darkness speaks like a ghost of the horror. Yet we also learn of the compassionate Roger Casement, who exposed so much colonial cruelty in Africa, the Americas, and in Ireland. The British government, however, rewarded this courageous early humanitarian with a cruel, punishing execution that sought to extinguish all memory of his goodness. The Rings of Saturn is a book about the ruins and incoherent fragments of the past that haunt the present. It emerged from Sebald's own period of severe depression, which is evoked at the start of the book. In August 1991, when the dog days were drawing to an end, I set off to walk the county of Suffolk in the hope of dispelling the emptiness that takes hold of me whenever I have completed a long stint of work. I wonder now, however, whether there might be something in the old superstition that certain ailments of the spirit and of the body are particularly likely to beset us under the sign of the dog star. At all events, in retrospect, I became preoccupied not only with the unaccustomed sense of freedom, but also with the paralyzing horror that had come over me at various times when confronted with the traces of destruction, reaching far back into the past, that were evident even in that remote place. Sebald, The Rings of Saturn. But it is a book that transcends a personal response to depression and celebrates with melancholy the obsessive creativity of humanity in the face of our fellow humans' destructiveness. It does not shy away from our common impotence before our all-too-human cruelty. This spirit makes The Rings of Saturn a book for our times, as we witness with renewed horror and frightening weakness the tragic killing in Gaza, Ukraine, Yemen, and other bloodlands of the world. The generations who live today may share something with the post-1945 generations of Germany, some of whom, like Sebald, knew a profound alienation from the complicity of leaders in perpetrating horrors, and yet sought to rescue from the rubble of the fragile cultures that was falling around them something to leave behind that was beyond all comparisons. Perhaps even Thomas Brown, who wrote 4 centuries ago, has some wise advice for us, we sad witnesses of another tragic year, where life is more terrible than death. It is then the truest valor to dare to live. And now on the Burning Archive, why don't you sit back and relax or continue your walk or commute and listen to my reading of W.G. Max Sebald's magnificent, wonderful book, The Rings of Saturn. In August 1992, when the dog days were drawing to an end, I set off to walk the country of Suffolk in the hope of dispelling the emptiness that takes hold of me whenever I have completed a long stint of work. And in fact, my hope was realized up to a point. For I have seldom felt so carefree as I did then, walking for hours in the day through the thinly populated countryside, which stretches inland from the coast. I wonder now whether there might be something in the old superstition that certain ailments of the spirit and of the body are particularly likely to beset us under the sign of the dog star. At all events, in retrospect, I became preoccupied not only with the unaccustomed sense of freedom, but also with the paralyzing horror that had come over me at various times when confronted with the traces of destruction reaching far back into the past that were evident even in that remote place. Perhaps it was because of this that, a year to the day after I began my tour, I was taken into hospital in Norwich in a state of almost total immobility. It was then that I began, in my thoughts, to write these pages. I can remember precisely how, upon being admitted to that room on the 8th floor, I became overwhelmed by the feeling that the Suffolk expanses I had walked the previous summer had now shrunk once and for all to a single blind, insensate spot. Indeed, all that could be seen of the world from my bed was the colourless patch of sky framed in the window. Several times during the day, I felt a desire to assure myself of a reality I feared had vanished forever by looking out of that hospital window, which, for some strange reason, was draped with black netting. And as dusk fell, the wish became so strong that, contriving to slip over the edge of the bed to the floor, half on my belly and half sideways, and then to reach the wall on all fours, I dragged myself, despite the pain, up to the windowsill. In the tortured posture of a creature that has raised itself erect for the first time, I stood leaning against the glass. I could not help thinking of the scene in which poor Gregor Samsa, his little legs trembling, climbs the armchair and looks out of his room. No longer remembering, so Kafka's narrative goes, the sense of liberation that gazing out of the window had formerly given him. And just as Grigor's dimmed eyes failed to recognize the quiet street where he and his family had lived for years, taking Charlottenstrasse for a grey wasteland, so I too found the familiar city extending from the hospital courtyards to the far horizon, an utterly alien place. I could not believe that anything might still be alive in that maze of buildings down there. Rather, it was as if I were looking down from a cliff upon a sea of stone or a field of rubble from which the tenebrous masses of multi-story car parks rose up like immense boulders. At that twilight hour, there were no passers-by to be seen in the immediate vicinity, but for a nurse crossing the cheerless gardens outside the hospital entrance on the way to her night shift. An ambulance with its light flashing was negotiating a number of turns on its way from the city centre to casualty. I could not hear its siren, and at that height I was cocooned in an almost complete and, as it were, artificial silence. All I could hear was the wind sweeping in from the country and buffeting the window, and in between, when the sound subsided, there was the never entirely ceasing murmur in my own ears. Now that I begin to assemble my notes more than a year after my discharge from hospital, I cannot help thinking of Michael Parkinson, who was, as I stood watching the city fade into the dying light, still alive in his small house in the Portersfield Road, busy perhaps preparing a seminar or working on his study of Charles Rameau's, which had occupied him for many years. Michael was in his late 40s, a bachelor, and I believe one of the most innocent people I have ever met. Nothing was ever further from his thoughts than self-interest. Nothing troubled him quite so much as the dire responsibility of performing his duties under increasingly adverse conditions. Above all, he was remarkable for the modesty of his needs, which some considered bordered on eccentricity. At a time when most people have constantly to be shopping in order to survive, Michael seemed to have no such need. Year in, year out, as long as I knew him, he wore either a navy blue or a rust-coloured jacket, and if the cuffs were frayed or the elbows threadbare, he would sew on leather trims or patches. He even turned the collars of his shirts himself. In the summer vacations, Michael would make long walking tours of the Valais and the area around Lake Geneva in connection with his Rameau's studies, and sometimes in the Jura or the Cevennes. It often seemed to me when he returned from these travels, or when I marvelled at the degree of dedication he always brought to his work, that in his own way he had found happiness, in a modest form that is scarcely conceivable nowadays. But then, without warning, last May, Michael, who had not been seen for some days, was found dead in his bed, lying on his side and already quite rigid, his face curiously mottled with red blotches. The inquest concluded that he had died of unknown causes, a verdict to which I added the words, "in the deep and dark hours of the night." The shock that went through us at this quite unexpected death affected no one more deeply than Jeanine Dakins, who, like Michael, was a lecturer in Romance languages and unmarried too. Indeed, one might say that she was so unable to bear the loss of the ingenuous, almost childlike friendship they had shared that a few weeks after his death, she succumbed to a disease that swiftly consumed her body. Jeanine, who lived in a lane next to the hospital, had, like Michael, studied at Oxford and over the years had come to a profound understanding of the 19th century French novel that had about it a certain private quality, wholly free of intellectual vanity, and was guided by a fascination for obscure detail rather than by the self-evident. Gustave Flaubert was for her by far the finest of writers, and on many occasions she quoted long passages from the thousands of pages of his correspondence, never failing to astound me. Jeanine had taken an intense personal interest in the scruples which dogged Flaubert's writing, that fear of the false which, she said, sometimes kept him confined to his couch for weeks or months on end, in the dread that he would never be able to write another word without compromising himself in the most grievous of ways. Moreover, Jeanine said, he was convinced that everything he had written hitherto consisted solely in a string of the most abysmal errors and lies, the consequences of which were immeasurable. Janine maintained that the source of Flaubert's scruples was to be found in the relentless spread of stupidity which he had observed everywhere and which he believed had already invaded his own head. It was, so supposedly once he said, as if one was sinking into sand. This was probably the reason, she said, that sand possessed such significance in all of Flaubert's works. Sand conquered all. Time and again, said Janine, vast dust clouds drifted through Flaubert's dreams by day and by night, raised over the arid plains of the African continent, and moving north across the Mediterranean and the Iberian Peninsula, till sooner or later they settled like ash from a fire on the Tuileries garden, a suburb of Rouen or a country town in Normandy, penetrating into the tiniest crevices. In a grain of sand in the hem of Emma Bovary's winter gown, said Janine, Flaubert saw the whole of the Sahara. For him, every speck of dust weighed as heavy as the Atlas Mountains. Many a time at the end of a working day, Janine would talk to me about Flaubert's view of the world. In her office, where there were such quantities of lecture notes, letters, and other documents lying around, that it was like standing amidst a flood of paper. On the desk, which was both the origin and the focal point of this amazing profusion of paper, a virtual paper landscape had come into being in the course of time with mountains and valleys. Like a glacier, when it reaches the sea, it had broken off at the edges and established new deposits all around on the floor, which in turn were advancing imperceptibly towards the centre of the room. Years ago, Janine had been obliged by the ever-increasing masses of paper on her desk to bring further tables into use, and these tables, where similar processes of accretion had subsequently taken place, represented later epochs, so to speak, in the evolution of Janine's paper universe. The carpet, too, had long since vanished beneath several inches of paper. Indeed, the paper had begun climbing from the floor on which year after year it had settled, and was now up the walls as high as the top of the doorframe, page upon page of memoranda and notes pinned up in multiple layers, all of them by just one corner. Wherever it was possible, there were piles of papers on the books of her shelves as well. It once occurred to me that at dusk, when all of this paper seemed to gather into itself the pallor of the fading light, it was like the snow in the fields long ago beneath the ink-black sky. In the end, Janine was reduced to working from an easy chair, drawn more or less into the middle of her room, where if one passed her door, which was always ajar, she could be seen bent almost double, scribbling on a pad on her knees, or sometimes just lost in thought. Once when I remarked that sitting there amidst her papers she resembled the angel in Dürer's Melancholia, steadfast among the instruments of destruction, her response was that the apparent chaos surrounding her represented in reality a perfect kind of order, or an order which at least tended towards perfection. And the fact was that whatever she might be looking for amongst her papers or her books or in her head, she was generally able to find right away. It was Janine who referred me to the surgeon Anthony Battishaw, whom she knew from the Oxford Society, when after my discharge from hospital, I began my inquiries about Thomas Brown, who had practiced as a doctor in Norwich in the 17th century and had left a number of writings that defy all comparison. An entry in the 1911 edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica had told me that Brown's skull was kept in the museum of the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital. Unequivocal though this claim appeared, my attempts to locate the skull in the very place where until recently I had been a patient met with no success, for none of the ladies and gentlemen of the present administrative staff at the hospital was aware that any such museum existed. Not only did they stare at me in utter incomprehension when I voiced my strange request, but I even had the impression that some of those I asked thought of me as an eccentric crank. Yet it is well known that in the period when public health and hygiene were being reformed and hospitals established, many of these institutions kept museums, or rather chambers of horrors, in which prematurely born, deformed or hydrocephalic fetuses, hypertrophied organs and other items of a similar nature were preserved in jars of formaldehyde for medical purposes and occasionally exhibited to the public. The question was where the things had got to. The local history of the section of the main library, which has since been destroyed by fire, was unable to give me any information concerning the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital and the whereabouts of Brown's skull. It was not until I made contact with Anthony Batty Shaw through Janine that I obtained the information I was after. Thomas Brown, so Batty Shaw wrote in an article he sent me, which he had just published in the Journal of Medical Biography, died in 1682 on his 77th birthday and was buried in the parish church of St. Peter Mancroft in Norwich. There his mortal remains lay undisturbed until 1840, when the coffin was damaged during preparations for another burial in the chancel and its contents partially exposed. As a result, Brown's skull and a lock of his hair passed into the possession of one Dr. Lubbock, a parish councillor who in turn left the relics in his will to the hospital museum, where they were put on display amidst various anatomical curiosities until 1921 under a bell jar. It was not until then that St. Peter Mancroft's repeated request for the return of Brown's skull was acceded to, and almost a quarter of a millennium after the first burial, a second interment was performed with all due ceremony. Curiously enough, Brown himself, in his famous part archaeological and part metaphysical treatise, Urn Burial, offers the most fitting commentary on the subsequent odyssey of his own skull, when he writes that to be gnawed out of our graves is a tragical abomination. But, he adds, who is to know the fate of his bones, or how often he is to be buried? Thomas Brown was born in London on the 19th of October 1605, the son of a silk merchant. Little is known of his childhood, and the accounts of his life following completion of his master's degree at Oxford tell us scarcely anything about the nature of his later medical studies. All we know for certain is that from his 25th birthday to his 28th year, he attended the universities of Montpellier, Padua, and Vienna, then outstanding in the Hippocratic sciences, and that just before returning to England, received a doctorate in medicine from Leiden. In January 1632, while Brown was in Holland, and thus at a time when he was engaging more profoundly with the mysteries of the human body than ever before, The dissection of a corpse was undertaken in public at the Wagabile in Amsterdam. The body being that of Adrian Adriaanszoon, alias Aris Kint, a petty thief of that city, who had been hanged for his misdemeanours an hour or so earlier. Although we have no definite evidence for this, it is probable that Brown would have heard of the dissection and was present at the extraordinary event, which Rembrandt depicted in his painting of the Guild of Surgeons. For the anatomy lessons given every year in the depth of winter by Dr. Nicholas Tulp were not only of the greatest interest to a student of medicine, but constituted in addition a significant date in the agenda of a society that saw itself as emerging from the darkness into the light. The spectacle, presented before a paying public drawn from the upper classes, was no doubt a demonstration of the undaunted investigative zeal in the new sciences, but it also represented, though this surely would have been refuted, the archaic ritual of dismembering a corpse, of harrowing the flesh of the delinquent even beyond death, a procedure then still part of the ordained punishment. That the anatomy lesson in Amsterdam was about more than a thorough knowledge of the inner organs of the human body is suggested by Rembrandt's representation of the ceremonial nature of the dissection. The surgeons are in their finest attire, and Dr. Tulp is wearing a hat on his head, as well as by the fact that afterwards there was a formal and, in a sense, symbolic banquet. If we stand today before the large canvas of Rembrandt's The Anatomy Lesson in the Mauritius, we are standing precisely where those who were present at the dissection in the Wagabile stood. And we believe that we see what they saw then. In the foreground, the greenish, prone body of Aris Kint, his neck broken and his chest risen terribly in rigor mortis. And yet it is debatable whether anyone ever really saw that body, since the art of anatomy then in its infancy was not least a way of making the reprobate body invisible. It is somehow odd that Dr. Tulp's colleagues are not looking at Kint's body, that their gaze is directed just past it, to focus on the open anatomical atlas in which the appalling physical facts are reduced to a diagram, a schematic plan of the human being, such as envisaged by the enthusiastic amateur anatomist René Descartes, who was also, so it is said, present that January morning in the Wagabal. In his philosophical investigations, which form one of the principal chapters in the history of subjection, Descartes teaches that one should disregard the flesh, which is beyond our comprehension, and attend to the machine within, to what can fully be understood, be made wholly useful for work, and in the event of any fault either repaired or discarded. Though the body is open to contemplation, it is, in a sense, excluded, and in the same way the much-admired verisimilitude of Rembrandt's picture proves on closer examination to be more apparent than real. Contrary to normal practice, the anatomist shown here has not begun his dissection by opening the abdomen and removing the intestines, which are most prone to putrefaction, but has started, and this too may imply a punitive dimension to the act, by dissecting the offending hand. Now this hand is most peculiar. It is not only grotesquely out of proportion compared with the hand closer to us, but it is also anatomically the wrong way round. The exposed tendons, which ought to be those of the left palm, given the position of the thumb, are in fact those of the back of the right hand. In other words, what we are faced with is a transposition taken from the Anatomical Atlas, evidently without further reflection, that turns this otherwise true-to-life painting, if one may so express it, into a crass misrepresentation at the exact centre point of its meaning, where the incisions are made. It seems inconceivable that we are faced here with an unfortunate blunder. Rather, I believe that there was deliberate intent behind this flaw in the composition. That unshapely hand signifies the violence that has been done to Aris Kint. It is with him, the victim, and not the guild that gave Rembrandt his commission, that the painter identifies. His gaze alone is free of Cartesian rigidity. He alone sees that greenish, annihilated body, and he alone sees the shadow in the half-open mouth and over the dead man's eyes. We have no evidence to tell us from which angle Thomas Brown watched the dissection, if, as I believe, he was among the onlookers in the Anatomy Theatre in Amsterdam, or indeed what he might have seen there. Perhaps, as Brown says in a later note about the great fog that shrouded large parts of England and Holland on the 27th of November, 1674. It was the white mist that rises from within a body opened presently after death, and which during our lifetime, so he adds, clouds our brain when asleep and dreaming. I still recall how my own consciousness was veiled by the same sort of fog as I lay in my hospital room once more after surgery late in the evening. Under the wonderful influence of the painkillers coursing through me, I felt in my iron-framed bed like a balloonist floating weightless amidst the mountainous clouds towering on every side. At times the billowing masses would part and I gazed out at the indigo vastness and down into the depths where I supposed the earth to be, a black and impenetrable maze. But in the firmament above were the stars, tiny points of gold speckling the barren wastes. Through the resounding emptiness, my ears caught the voices of the two nurses who took my pulse and from time to time moistened my lips with a small pink sponge attached to a stick, which reminded me of the Turkish Delight lollipops we used to buy at the fair. Katie and Lizzie were the names of these ministering angels, and I think I have rarely been as elated as I was in their care that night. Of the everyday matters they chattered about, I understood very little. All I heard was the rise and fall of their voices, a kind of warbling such as comes from the throats of birds, a perfect fluting sound, part celestial and part the song of sirens. Of all the things Katie said to Lizzie and Lizzie to Katie, I remember only one odd scrap. I think Katie or Lizzie was describing a holiday on Malta where, she said, the Maltese, with a death-defying insouciance quite beyond comprehension, drove neither on the left nor on the right, but always on the shady side of the road. It was not until dawn, when the morning shift relieved the night nurses, that I realized where I was. I became aware again of my body, the insensate foot and the pain in my back. I heard the rattle of crockery as the hospital's daily routine started in the corridor, and as the first light brightened the sky, I saw a vapour trail cross the segment framed by my window. At the time I took that white trail for a good omen, but now, as I look back, I fear it marked the beginning of a fissure that has since riven my life. The aircraft at the tip of the trail was as invisible as the passengers inside it. The invisibility and intangibility of that which moves us remained an unfathomable mystery for Thomas Brown too, who saw our world as no more than a shadow image of another one far beyond. In his thinking and writing, he therefore sought to look upon earthly existence from the things that were closest to him to the spheres of the universe with the eye of an outsider, one might even say of the creator. His only means of achieving the sublime heights that this endeavour required was a parlous loftiness in his language. In common with other English writers of the 17th century, Brown wrote out of the fullness of his erudition, deploying a vast repertoire of quotations and the names of authorities who had gone before, creating complex metaphors and analogies, and constructing labyrinthine sentences that sometimes extend over one or two pages, sentences that resemble processions or a funeral cortege in their sheer ceremonial lavishness. It is true that, because of the immense weight of the impediments he is carrying, Brown's writing can be held back by the force of gravitation. But when he does succeed in rising higher and higher through the circles of his spiraling prose, borne aloft like a glider on warm currents of air, even today the reader is overcome by a sense of levitation. The greater the distance, the clearer the view. One sees the tiniest of details with the utmost clarity. It is as if one were looking through a reversed opera glass and through a microscope at the same time. And yet, says Brown, all knowledge is enveloped in darkness. What we perceive are no more than isolated lights in the abyss of ignorance, in the shadow-filled edifice of the world. We study the order of things, says Brown, but we cannot grasp their innermost essence, and because it is so, it befits our philosophy to be writ small, using the shorthand and contracted forms of transient nature, which alone are a reflection of eternity. True to his own prescription, Brown records the patterns which recur in the seemingly infinite diversity of forms. In the Garden of Cyrus, for instance, he draws the quincunx, which is composed by using the corners of a regular quadrilateral and the point at which its diagonals intersect. Brown identifies this structure everywhere, in animate and inanimate matter, in certain crystalline forms, in starfish and sea urchins, in the vertebrae of mammals and the backbones of birds and fish, in the skins of various species of snake, in the crosswise prints left by quadrupeds, in the physical shapes of caterpillars, butterflies, silkworms and moths, in the root of the water fern, in the seed husks of the sunflower and the Caledonian pine, within young oak shoots or the stem of the horsetail, and in the creations of mankind in the pyramids of Egypt and the mausoleum of Augustus, as in the garden of King Solomon, which was planted with mathematical precision with pomegranate trees and white lilies. Examples might be multiplied without end, says Brown, and one might demonstrate ad infinitum the elegant geometrical designs of nature. However, thus with a fine turn of phrase and image, he concludes his treatise. The constellation of the Hyades, the quincunx of heaven, is already sinking beneath the horizon. And so 'tis time to close the five ports of knowledge. We are unwilling to spin out our waking thoughts into the phantasmes of sleep, making cables of cobwebs and wildernesses of handsome groves. Besides, he adds, Hippocrates, in his notes on sleeplessness, has spoken so little of the miracle of plants that there is scant encouragement to dream of paradise, not least since in practice we are occupied above all by the abnormalities of creation, be they the deformities produced by sickness or the grotesqueries with which nature, with an inventiveness scarcely less diseased, fills every vacant space in her atlas. And indeed, while on the one hand the study of nature today aims to describe a system governed by immutable laws, on the other it delights in drawing our attention to creatures noteworthy for their bizarre physical form or behaviour. Even in Brehm's Theorleben, a popular 19th century zoological compendium, pride of place is given to the crocodile and the kangaroo, the anteater and the armadillo, the seahorse and the pelican. And nowadays we are shown on the television screen a colony of penguins, say, standing motionless through the long, dark winter of the Antarctic, with its icy storms, on their feet the eggs laid at a milder time of year. In programs of this kind, which are called Nature Watch or Survival and are considered particularly educational, one is more likely to see some monster coupling at the bottom of Lake Baikal than an ordinary blackbird. Thomas Brown, too, was often distracted from his investigations into the isomorphic line of the quincunx by singular phenomena that fired his curiosity and by work on a comprehensive pathology. He is said to have long kept a bittern in his study in order to find out how this peculiar bird could produce from the depths of its throat such a strange bassoon-like sound, unique in the whole of nature and in the Pseudodoxia Epidemica, in which he dispels popular errors and legends. He deals with beings both real and imaginary, such as the chameleon, the salamander, the ostrich, the griffin, and the phoenix, the basilisk, the unicorn, and the amphisbaena, the serpent with two heads. In most cases, Brown refutes the existence of the fabled creatures, but the astonishing monsters that we know to be properly part of the natural world leave us with a suspicion that even the most fantastical beasts might not be mere inventions. At all events, it is clear from Brown's account that the endless mutations of nature, which go far beyond any rational limit, and equally the chimeras produced by our own minds, were as much a source of fascination to him as they were 300 years later to Jorge Luis Borges, whose Libro de los Seres Imaginarios was published in Buenos Aires in 1967. Recently, I realized that the imaginary beings listed alphabetically in that compendium include the creature Boldanders, whom Simplicius Simplicissimus encounters in the sixth book of Grimmelhausen's narrative. There Bardanders is first seen as a stone sculpture lying in a forest, resembling a Germanic hero of old and wearing a Roman soldier's tunic with a big Swabian beard. Bardanders claims to have come from paradise, to have always been in Simplicius's company, unbeknownst to him, and to be unable to quit his side until Simplicius shall have reverted to the clay he is made of. Then, before the very eyes of Simplicius, Bardanders changes into a scribe who writes these lines, and then into a mighty oak, a sow, a sausage, a piece of excrement, a field of clover, a white flower, a mulberry tree, and a silk carpet. Much as in this continuous process of consuming and being consumed, nothing endures in Thomas Brown's view. On every new thing there lies already the shadow of annihilation. For the history of every individual, of every social order, indeed of the whole world, does not describe an ever-widening, more and more wonderful arc, but rather follows a course which, once the meridian is reached, leads without fail down into the dark. Knowledge of that descent into the dark for Brown is inseparable from his belief in the day of resurrection. When, as in a theatre, the last revolutions are ended and the actors appear once more on stage to complete and make up the catastrophe of this great piece. As a doctor who saw disease growing and raging in the bodies, he understood mortality better than the flowering of life. To him it seems a miracle that we should last so much as a single day. "There is no antidote," he writes, "against the opium of time. The winter sun shows how soon the light fades from the ash, how soon night enfolds us, how hour upon hour is added to the sum. Time itself grows old. Pyramids, arches and obelisks are melting pillars of snow. Not even those who have found a place amidst the heavenly constellations have perpetuated their names. Nimrod is lost in Orion and Osiris in the dog star. Indeed, old families last not three oaks." To set one's name to a work gives no one a title to be remembered, for who knows how many of the best of men have gone without a trace. The iniquity of oblivion blindly scatters her poppy seed, and when wretchedness falls upon us one summer's day like snow, all we wish for is to be forgotten. These are the circles Brown's thoughts describe, most unremittingly perhaps in the hydrotaphia or urn burial of 1658, a discourse on sepulchral urns found in a field near Walsingham in Norfolk. Drawing upon the most varied of historical and natural historical sources, he expatiates upon the rites we enact when one from our midst sets out on his last journey, beginning with some examples of sepulture in elephants, cranes, the sepulchral cells of pismires, and the practice of bees, which civil society carrieth out their dead and have exequies, if not interments. He describes the funeral rites of numerous peoples before coming to the Christian religion, which buries the sinful body whole and thus extinguishes the fires once and for all. The almost universal practice of cremation in pre-Christian times should not lead one to conclude, as is often done, that the heathen were ignorant of life beyond death. To show which, Brown observes that the funeral pyres were built of sweet fuel, cypress, fir, yew, and other trees perpetually verdant, as silent expressions of their surviving hopes. Brown also remarks that, contrary to general belief, it is not difficult to burn a human body. A piece of an old boat burnt Pompeii, and the King of Castile burnt large numbers of Saracens with next to no fuel, the fire being visible far and wide. Indeed, he adds, if the burden of Isaac were sufficient for an holocaust, a man may carry his own pyre. Brown then turns to the strange vessels unearthed from the field near Walsingham. It is astounding, he says, how long these thin-walled clay urns remained intact, a yard underground, while the sword and the ploughshare passed above them, and great buildings, palaces, and cloud-high towers crumbled and collapsed. The cremated remains in the urns are examined closely. The ash, the loose teeth, some long roots of quitch or dog's grass wreathed about the bones, and the coin intended for the Elysian ferryman. Brown records other objects known to have been placed with the dead, whether as ornament or utensil. His catalogue includes a variety of curiosities: the circumcision knives of Joshua, the ring which belonged to the mistress of Propertius, an ape of agate, a grasshopper, 300 golden bees, a blue opal, silver belt buckles and clasps, combs, iron pins, brass plates and brazen nippers to pull away hair, and a brass jew's harp that last sounded on the crossing over the black water. The most marvellous item, however, from a Roman urn preserved by Cardinal Farnese is a drinking glass, so bright it might have been newly blown. For Brown, things of this kind, unspoiled by the passage of time, are symbols of the indestructibility of the human soul, assured by Scripture, which the physician, firm though he may be in his Christian faith, perhaps secretly doubts. And since the heaviest stone that melancholy can throw at a man is to tell him he is at the end of his nature, Brown scrutinizes that which escaped annihilation for any sign of the mysterious capacity for transmigration he has so often observed in caterpillars and moths. That purple piece of silk he refers to then in the urn of Patroclus. What does it mean? I hope you enjoyed that reading, and I will be back next week with more reflections on history, culture, and our changing world to help you see the world more clearly with history. Quality world history. Take care, everyone.